you all can see, we've been chatting for a little bit now, and I think it is time to talk about what we all came here for, and that is project management or product management or problem management within the ML and MLOps space. We've got three incredible people here with us today, and I was going to mention, but I don't know if it, I probably shouldn't because it should just be normal, but we've got an awesome panel that is super diverse right now. It's not at all the normal kind of panel you should see, but like I said one time to the first woman that we had on the MLOps community meetups, I said, oh, this is awesome. I want to announce that you're the first woman that we've had on here and it's a big thing. She was like, no, don't say anything because that will like make it like it's not normal. And it should be normal that it's just a woman here talking about coding. And so then I shut my mouth. So I could not help myself right. This time. And I want to mention that we have an awesome, diverse panel, but it should be normal. And we're going to try and make it normal as much as we can. Let's get into this today. I am super excited to have Vessi, Simar, and Corey with us because we've been brainstorming a few ideas on what we want to talk about. And I think it is only proper to kick it off with one of the questions that Corey, and if anyone knows Corey, you know that he loves to think long-term. And so I think we should kick it off with this question that Corey has been bouncing around in his mind and really thinking about a lot and deeply about. And it's the difference between delivering a product that solves today's problems and delivering one that solves tomorrow's problems. So how do you think ahead? How do you get into that vision of where we're going to be in the future? And maybe Corey, you can kick us off and then we'll let everyone else bounce around us a few ideas.
No, awesome. Thanks for that, Demetrios, because or Meech, let me make sure I say that right. It's something that I do think about a lot is that I feel that sometimes it's so easy to say this is today's challenge. For instance, let's be super, super simple. For an example, hey, I just need to move a gigabyte of data, you know, super simple. I might need a terabyte in a year. That's great. But what about when you really think about your business or your use case and you think about, you cast that vision into the future? Where do you think things are going to be? It kind of like have a big, hairy, audacious goal, or I like to think about a big, hairy, audacious challenge. I like to think about the challenges we're going to deal with in the future and kind of build your product and your team around that challenge. Yes, solve today's problem, but make sure that you're flexible enough to solve the really, really hard stuff. Because sooner or later, if you only worry about today, oh, you're gonna pay that bill. And when that bill comes due, it's not going to be pretty. I think a lot of organizations have bumped into that challenge. So what I like to do, I'm data informed. I like to think about the growth of my business, my customers. I like to think about the competencies of the teams that I'm working with, because if they aren't competent in dealing with the really hairy stuff, let's ramp them up in preparation for that. Other than having folks who only know Excel when I really need Spark. You know, today Excel, tomorrow Spark. And so really just trying to think about that and leverage that. So it's a lot of that squishy stuff. That's kind of how I help to get ahead of that. But also I'm an innovator as well. I try to read about different articles. I try to meet with different people. Like, you know, we have Simmer here from Intuit. It's like, hey, how are you guys challenging that? Hey, Vessalina, how have you guys been thinking about that stuff? You have to be willing to learn and take all of those learnings and how they apply best to your business to prepare for tomorrow, because there's too many organizations of different sizes, scope, scale, to not come into a position or a situation with intelligence and expectations. So that's kind of how I think about it.
Yeah, and exactly. I think you have to keep different sources of information open in order to, you know, prepare for the next thing. Some of the things, you know, I mean, we are so blessed with the ML community, right? You hear so many different people actually talking about different things. So it gives you kind of a sense around where people might be going directionally, you know, when you hear in a big community. So one is that, right? And internally also, like, you know, within our company, always keeping your ears and eyes open to what people are trying out things, right? You know, we see people, you know, sometimes you only find out new things from data scientists who started doing new things, and, you know, something that came fresh in the market, they wanted to explore it, try it for research. So always keeping an eye on, like, you know, what new things people are trying nowadays. So that's has been very helpful. And then, you know, then you actually go and ask different other groups as well, like, hey, would you actually see such a need in future? So as a product manager, like, this is what, you know, making sure that if you see a pattern in one group, you kind of go and validate it against different groups to see if such a pattern is kind of, you know, consistent across different groups. And then you think, like, okay, maybe there is a need to platformize, or, you know, make it as a capability across the board. So that's how, you know, I would approach it, you know, and I have done it in my work. Yeah.
I definitely agree with both you guys. And maybe I like that Corey mentioned observing and knowing your team, knowing their capabilities, knowing what motivates them even. Because if you have a vision for something really big, you need to be able to execute it with your team. You cannot execute a vision all by yourself. So if your team is not ready to execute along with you, you need to make the needed steps to get them there. Whether it's skills, whether it's mindset, it's a lot of things that needs to happen. With my team, we had similar challenges, and everybody needed to walk their own path until we get to the same point where we are ready to execute the vision that we have for our product. And this takes time. And for everybody, it's different time. And what Simar mentioned about the end users is very on point, because you need to know what everybody needs and be open, not only with your eyes, but with your mind, with your ears, with everything about what is happening. And if I have to add one more thing to what he mentioned, if you are able to go outside of the machine learning and take know-how from somewhere else as well, that can really enrich what you're doing on your project, because there are a lot of great practices and things that can be taken and implemented into the machine learning world as well.
Mm. I'm loving all this. This is so good. I'll add one other thing is that there was a quote, and I kind of live by it, is that the future is already out there. You just have to find it. And I think it's on our ownership as product and product managers not to be so inundated where we can't have that white space to really seek out and understand, does that future align with our vision? And if it doesn't, maybe there's some reconciliation that needs to occur. And so it's just making sure you have that time to do that. And if you do that well, you're golden. People are going to love everything you push out there to a certain degree. Not everybody's going to love everything you do. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it would be good to know sometime, like, what was your experience? What was one thing people didn't like? And maybe what was your learning from it? Yeah, but all good points, yes.
So I'm hearing a lot of this idea how communication is so important. And when you need to go out and talk with people to really bounce ideas off of them and see, hey, this product that this other team is using, do you think it would be useful for you? Do you all have any process when you are going out and shopping around ideas, or when you're looking at the future of where the product is going and you need to talk with others to get the opinions or advice from them? Is there a process that you use as you go through it?
I can go first because I already recommended this in the group. We use the MUM test. I think it's very, very important how you ask questions. And oftentimes, people that are building products, they tend to ask questions that are kind of closed and might affect the person who is responding. And you might not get a real answer in terms of something that is bringing you value in order to then be able to pass it to your team and the team can build features upon that. So it's very important how you ask questions. The book is very, very small and you can read it like in a few hours and it's very valuable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry, what was the book you said mentioned?
The Monk Test.
Okay.
I'll throw that in the chat right now too for anybody that is interested. It is such a amazing book.
Right. I mean, the process that, you know, I have followed is basically, you know, it depends, like, first of all, like when people are throwing ideas also, like, you know, you have to also first see, you know, as a product manager, first of all, I have to be very clear, like, who am I building this product for, right? And, you know, principally, like whether you know, traditionally product managers, we build like product for, you know, the kind of product that you see in the market, right? You know, consumer product or whichever kind of user facing product. But when we come onto the MLOps, I think principally the things remain same, right? We want to build great experiences for our users. And there is specific metrics we would define to measure success for that, right? So those principally, it remains the same. What differences now is like, you know, is the kind of users you are dealing with. Like, you know, now we are dealing with way more like technical, diverse technical people, like, you know, at least in the MLOps world. So you have analysts, you have data scientists, you have machine learning engineers, software engineers, you know. Externally, when you are selling a product, you have these citizen data scientists, also word used, right? So we have all these different technical personas, right? So that's the kind of difference that you find. And then you have to be very focused on like, okay, you know, I want to build a solution, or I want to build this whatever product, whom am I building this for? And then when you're vetting your ideas, then you also make sure, you know, the ideas that are coming in your way, towards you, and you have to think through like, who are you then focused on, like, you know, because sometimes the idea might come to you and it might not be exactly for that user who you want to focus on. So you have to be very clear that is it a distraction, or is it something that aligns with my focus or my customer segment in this case that I want to build this product for. So in terms of maybe filtering the ideas, you can see which ideas I want to focus on. And then, you know, I think, like, you know, as we have been doing, you know, as a product managers, we prepare some kind of mock-ups, you know, walk through with the users in terms of experience. Like if we are building, you know, some kind of user interface, like, for example, we do a lot of toolings with different products, then how will that experience will look like, you know, and actually, like, the good thing is in my current company, we have a lot of data science community. So we get, you know, very immediate access to these users, and we can get the firsthand, kind of feedback from them, walking them through it. So it's the same thing. We haven't yet built the product, but we are just getting that first feedback around the ideas. And once we have that, you know, we can actually see which one of those ideas makes sense. And then, you know, we get into all those things around buy versus build, like how should we bring in these things into like when we're as a product manager working within a company, right? So we're building internally platforms and solutions. So again, there is always a question on buy and build. And so all those things, you know, we have to also take into consideration.
Maybe that's a good segue into what we were chatting about before we hit record and let everyone in. And this idea of when you're building a product for an internal customer or when you're building a product for an external customer, and how those what's the difference between those two? And so I think, if I'm not mistaken, Corey and Simmer, you're both building products for internal customers. That's and right. Vessi, you're building a product for an external customer. So it might be good to hear like Corey and Simmer's perspective, and then Vessi, and also how you look at it from the other way around when you're what you think it would be like if you were in the other person's shoes.
Why you gotta come up the hard questions right there? He's like, you know, so now we have to change personas right here. So yes, definitely thinking about from the internal customer standpoint. And one of the big considerations I at least have as we're having these internal discussions is really, why are we doing what we're doing? What is the underlying purpose? When you think about the old school project management tool, 5 Whys, it's so powerful. Some folks are like, oh, that sounds easy. Like, trust me, try it and see, at least for the listeners, and you'll uncover some stuff. And so the big thing is really defining what is the business value, the ROI, and what, like, the expected ROI for this. And I think that's a really, really huge and undervalued discussion from the data science space, specifically when we start talking about MLOps, is what is the ROI for me building this in-house platform, maintaining this in-house platform, upgrading this in-house platform, and the total cost of ownership for that? What resources do I need to do that? Okay, great. This is $1 million. Why don't I go look out to the community in the marketplace and find somebody that does this well, that is awesome at it, that does all of those things, and I'm willing to spend $200,000 a year. For us, it's a win. For them, they get an opportunity to work with us. So I think it just becomes a win-win there. But those are conversations that we really, really have to. It goes back to that build, buy. And I think there's a third option, build, buy, or hybrid. Because there's kind of that option, that thinking where the really hard, hard stuff, and Sim, I'd love your opinion here, the really complicated things is like, I really get my engineering teams to do this. Like, this is not going to be easy. This is a year ordeal. This is so forth, so on. Let's buy that. Let's reach out. And I'm a big fan of the startup community. So I love kind of connecting with folks through the MLOps community as well. And so that's like tier one for me when I think about from internal. Tier two is really thinking about talent, skill sets, having the right people there. Because guess what? If I don't have the right folks to build it and support this, it's dead on arrival. Because people start using something, they can't use it, or it's like, hey, this is broken. And you only have one engineer supporting that, or two engineers supporting 3,000 people. It's not going to work. And so that becomes like that second thing. And then probably the third thing that I think about from an internal kind of building a platform out is really starting to think about this whole, and I think I've used this reference before in some of our chats. Like, if you've ever seen the movie Field of Dreams, there's always this concept, if you build it, they will come. I think that is so false in our space. If you build it, that doesn't mean they're going to come. That doesn't mean they're going to adopt it. And so really, really staying aligned on who you're serving and how do you raise adoptability? Because if I've spent 2 years building this internal platform, whether it's Agile or Waterfall, whatever your company or organization size, I need to make sure that my people use this. And if they're not going to use it, and it's so painful and so difficult for them to use, they're going to do this shadow IT, shadow MLOps, shadow data science thing. And now you have a completely different problem. Because guess what? You're the central team that supports that stuff. Who's on the hook? You. And so those are some things that I think about. I'll be quiet right now. And I guess we'll do the flip afterwards. And I'll move on what that would be like to build for other people. I have thoughts.
Just to jump in quickly before Simar, I think that Corey mentioned the biggest fear of every product manager is building something that nobody wants. That is the biggest fear.
Yeah. So, I mean, for us, like when we are, you know, building a platform internally, so as Corey mentioned, like all those points that, you know, first, we need to make sure, ROI from ROI standpoint, is this investment, you know, worth it or not? So for example, like, you know, it also depends how soon do you want to get that thing in the hands of the user also, right? Once you have determined that this is a usable capability that all of the folks are asking for, then you look at, okay, you know, if we have to build it internally, in that also you have to look at, is this a core thing? Is this going to be a core thing of our platform? Because sometimes you have to take into consideration, or if we depend on some external vendor, you know, we might not be able to enhance it at that or customize it the way we always want, because then we have to depend on them, the way they release few things and then go in their cycle. So depending on, like, is it going to be really the core thing of our of our platform that could be into consideration, and also how much mature that space is also, right? Because I will give you an example from our product. So Feature Store, right? Feature Store, we started talking, you know, a lot in the last 1 year, I think, but our team needed like that 2 years ago. At that time, you know, we didn't actually see in the market there were a lot of mature solutions available, and we felt a need that we need to build this internally, and something which our user needed immediately. So all those things sometimes come into consideration. And then depending on which space you are also in, right? Like since we are in the financial services space, so compliance, security, all these aspects become also very important. Then we have to look at, you know, when we are evaluating, let's say, vendors in terms of, you know, adopting their solution, then we have to also look at how easy it would be to incorporate their solution into our systems, so that it still, you know, follows that compliance, security, privacy, all those needs. And we are able to, you know, provide that feature as soon as possible. And while we are doing all this, what are we really, you know, optimizing for? What is our success metric? For us, it is the developer velocity. So as an internal platform, right? I mean, we are not always very closely tied to the revenue, right? We are more like a cost center, right? To the company, right? We are actually, you know, with the infrastructure and everything, we are increasing the cost to the company. But when we look at what value are we providing, we have to look at internally how we are accelerating the teams that want to build models and then want to productionalize their pipelines. So how quickly can they do it? So our success metric is the developer velocity, like, you know, whether we achieve it through self-service, whether we achieve through automation, or we achieve, you know, a different other means by which we can say now the user is able to get their models out in their actual product that we have from weeks to days, right? Or from months to weeks. So that's how we measure the success of whatever we are, you know, developing.
I think that's a great point too, just to mention before Vesti goes, is that key metric that you're measuring for is probably going to be different for every team. And you're looking at that one thing that is like your, what do they call it? The hero metric, I think is what it is. And that's really what you want to be optimizing for. And so not losing sight of that is a huge learning. So Vesti, I'll let you take over for building products for the outside world, which I think is a whole nother beast, because especially in the MLOps world, there are so many different styles of how people are doing things. So I feel like it's just got to be really difficult to keep that in mind. And then also what we were talking about before, like planning ahead for the future and making sure that you're not building a product that is going to be left behind because the future came faster than you thought.
Yeah, definitely. I think that there are some similarities between both building product for internal use and both building a product for external use and for everybody, like you said. Like the biggest difference that I see is when you're building an internal product, you basically build it for one general use case, which is your company. It has some kind of business, and you are set up with some kind of metrics from the business. Then you have some machine learning teams. The business have a vision about how machine learning will be developing in the next 5-10 years, and you need to make sure your product, your platform checks with that as well. And also then on the lower level, you need to make sure that your product also checks with the current needs of the team. Again, we touch upon what Corey mentioned in the beginning about vision, like for current needs and for long-term needs. And you also, something that you need to be always aware of is the rest of the market. Even though you're building an internal platform, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't keep an eye on what other people are building in terms of platforms and also platform providers, because at some point you might be and you might end up with so custom solutions that each time you make a new hire for your machine learning team, they will have a certain set skill for most common platforms that are used. And then when they come to your team, if your platform is so non-standard and nothing like everything else on the market, you might end up training your team for a long time, which is some kind of challenge that is maybe far in the future, but you need to be aware of the standard practices that are adopted along the way and along the journey of the entire ecosystem. Like what everyone else is doing, you need to keep that in mind when you're building internal products. And on the other hand, when you're building a product for everyone else, you should not build a product for everyone else, but you should pick your niche and you should make sure you're not building a Frankenstein. This is the core thing, because if you're solving everybody's problems, you're not solving anyone's problems. I know it sounds like lots of cliches, but it's true. And what we aim with our vision is to have a long-term vision about what problems we want to solve. Then we try to split that into different parts of which we are going through in time and define our niche, which we start with. Then we solve the problems of this niche. This niche are specific users like Simar. Spoke about, you need to know who your user is. I tend to be more averse from making like names. Our users are data scientists, our users are machine learning engineers. This is the first thing I realized when I started doing customer development. It doesn't matter what the name is. These guys, like in each company, they do various stuff and they have various problems. So if I have to define customers just by their job name, it won't work for us. And yeah, you need to stay aware of your vision. And at the same time, you don't have to serve everybody. And there will be a lot of use cases. And some of them might seem fitting to what you're doing in the long term, but some of them might not. And you should make sure you don't allow that many features that are not aligning with your vision to end up entering your product, because in the end it will become something different and you deviate from whatever you're doing.
Such a great point.
Yeah, I mean, I have a question, Vesi, for you. I mean, you brought up an interesting point that you do not necessarily think about your users as like the ones which I call are like machine learning engineer, data scientists, and others. And what I'm also finding, you know, internally also, like the boundaries are sometimes blurring between them. Like they do different things, like, you know, people depending on what their skills are. So then how are you, thinking about, like, you know, focusing on your, like in terms of your product, because what I find sometimes very kind of pulled across two dimensions is like, should I focus on, you know, more user interface driven things where, you know, people can actually do a lot of things on their in self-serve manner. And then there are folks, who likes to interact with APIs. They want to get into like Kubernetes things, pods, memory, and all that stuff also. So how are you like in this space, given your understanding of the space today, like as an external, like, you know, product builder, how are you dealing with these changes coming in the market today?
Well, I try to focus on the problems, on where we can bring the most value and what the impact will be of bringing value exactly for this problem. And in order to be able to somehow target those people and find them and put labels on them, I try to look at the team organization, because I realize that there is a lot of links in terms of what people do in a machine learning team. If you know how their team is structured, like if they hired only data scientists, if they hired machine learning engineers, how many people they are. Also, if they have, if their machine learning product is core business or it's not core business. And there are a lot of factors which which define the needs of each specific machine learning team. In your case, I think that since you are one organization, it's just good to evaluate really well how all the different machine learning data scientists, the DevOps, MLOps, whatever teams you have, how they work together, because in the end, you're making a platform. You're not making a tool just for one of those users. And it's very important to understand how they work together and how you can improve the not only the ways they do stuff, but also the process that they do stuff together, if I make sense.
Yeah. No, I think we have had constant challenge in, like, as you said, different groups have different way of doing things. Some teams have machine learning engineers who will help teams to productionalize their pipelines. Some teams don't have them at all. Like, they are totally depending on us saying, like, you know, help, give us a way we can, like, analysts. There are analyst groups who are now saying, like, oh, we want to also get into, like, using machine learning to power some of the, you know, analyst experiences or whatever they, you know, work is given to them. But they don't know how to, you know, deploy things in production. So then we are like, okay, you know, we might have to think about what we need to, how do we accelerate them? So it's a constant kind of challenge I find, like, you know, different groups kind of, you know, asking for different things. And then again, like, you know, there is this message sometimes you find from your organization, like as a company as a whole, that we want to democratize machine learning, right? Mm-hmm. We hear this word a lot, democratization of machine learning. I mean, I find like, I don't know how, like, what does that mean sometime? Is it like anybody, I'm just like thinking like an executive VP sitting here saying like, I'm going to deploy a machine learning pipeline today. Like, I don't know. I mean, you need to know certain things, right? And to responsibly do certain things also. And then, so, I find that to be a constant challenge, at least in my work. Yeah.
And if you look at, I remember back when we used to go into conferences and you would see all the different tools and how one tooling approach is with a GUI, the other tooling approach is very software development driven. And like you said, using APIs. And so you get to see the different ways that these tools are opinionated. And when you're trying to build something for your internal customer and the internal customer wants one of this and one of that, it's very hard to be opinionated on both because it is such a long development cycle and it is a much harder feature to add in, just throw in a GUI. And so it's not quite the same. So I can see that. Corey, though, I saw you had something. What were you about to say?
I was just going to agree with Simmer. Like it is sometimes a challenge, kind of balancing all of those pieces, because you have different teams and departments that want to do their own thing, and there are some that want to do their own thing but really don't know how to do their own thing, and you're kind of like, hey, you know what? This is what we do. Let put us in the game, coach. And so there's a lot of that. It's funny, and maybe you and I can also compare notes outside of this. Because at 5 p.m. today, I have like a delayed email from my leadership kind of saying this is how we're going to kind of democratize some of these things. I'm big on delayed emails. Like that is the best way to send it and then think about it and be like, oh, you know what? I should change something before they go out. But yeah, it's been a challenge. It's something I've also worked with a lot of my IT counterparts as well to kind of think about. Because sometimes some folks want to have like the reins on everything and say anything, all of this platform that we're building, I don't care what you're doing, you must work in this platform. And if we don't support it, too bad, so sad, give us money to build it out. And I'm totally against that type of model for an organization because if you do that, you now kind of, the business will outgrow you and you get into that shadow IT, shadow data science, shadow all of that, where verticals in the business are now doing their own thing because you weren't supporting it in the first place. And so now they're running off into the sunset, not thinking about security, not thinking about scalability, not thinking about this. And then all of that stuff occurs. And then when something catastrophic happens, who ends up having to pick up the pieces?
Right. Corey, before we move on, can you explain what that shadow IT is real fast? Because there was a question coming through in the chat and I also didn't know, to be fair.
Yeah, it's and Simmer and Bessie, definitely chime in if you want to add anything to it. My understanding when you think about like shadow IT, shadow MLOps, shadow data ops or anything is when due to like inadequacies with some like your core competencies, like let's say, for instance, let's use data, like having a data pipeline. You have a team that does that and then there's another team that needs something unique, or maybe they just aren't communicating with the team that does that well. They now do it off on their own. And so what happens is that there end up being some really huge gaps there because it becomes like it's not your core competency, A. B, you're probably not following any of our internal requirements. Hey, why is this an open API on the public internet? So anybody that works in this space knows, don't do that. Don't just have something open that touches your internal systems because they're not thinking about those things or even having certain levels of compliance and so forth. And then one of my big things that I'm always a big fan of, like people push a model into production and they call it production, but they don't have monitoring. They don't have it registered in the model registry. They don't have any of these other things that need to be there for it to be considered production because they've gone off into the sunset and they've done their own thing. And that's where that shadow stuff comes from. Yeah,
no, absolutely. I think that's a very important area that, you know, we have also faced many times where, yeah, of course, like different teams, they will go and without much, you know, knowledge and sharing with us, like, you know, we needed this, they will gonna continue to build certain things on their own. And they run into problems around compliance, security. I know these words really sound bad, especially, you know, when people are saying, we want to innovate, we want to move fast and all that. But when you're working in bigger organization where there are a lot of things at stake, right, especially with users' privacy, their information getting leaked out and all that, I mean, these type of things, you know, people have to take care of for. And we as an organization, as somebody who's responsible for building a central platform for the whole organization, then we are questioned, like, why didn't you see this thing coming? And what did you do to avoid such things? So these are practices you do find in within companies, and you have to, you know, make sure you educate them, right? Especially in the time that we are now today, where, you know, user privacy is so much important, and then we are talking about ethics, bias, you know, fairness. So, and this is where this monitoring that Corey just mentioned becomes also important. How do, unless we are actually monitoring end-to-end pipeline, how do we bring these, you know, checks on bias if it's getting incorporated into your, you know, system? So that's a very important area, especially it's becoming more and more important for us now.
Completely. So there's, sorry, Vessi, did you want to chime in there? I saw you come off mute.
I was just wanting to say that the odd thing is that over our research for our product, I've noticed this problem not only with bigger companies that have many daughter little companies and everybody's doing a different thing and they don't have a standardized way and they have a lot of risks due to that. But this is also very common in smaller teams, like just a couple of people, and they have like two or three data scientists, and these guys, three people, are writing models in different frameworks, and everybody's doing their own thing, and then somebody is hired to standardize things, and it's a living hell, and this is more common than I expected.
Yeah.
So there's a great question that I wanted to get to before we start winding down. And this is about the team structures and really like not team structures, the mindset of organizations who treat machine learning as a product versus the mindset of organizations who treat machine learning as a project. And Vessi, maybe you can start with your thoughts on this.
Sure. Yeah, that is one of my favorite topics about mindsets around how machine learning is introduced into a company. And the first thing I think is whether the company is building a machine learning product that is core business and something that is not really core business. It's most common with companies that this is core business that they do products, and for companies that it's not core business, they treat it like a project, like something that is one-off. And basically, it's it's in some cases it might be okay to treat something like that like a project, but you need to make sure that somebody is taking care after that about of this model of the maintenance and that it works well in production. It's okay if this is not something that is done within your company. There are more and more companies that are offering outsourcing services, maintaining building models from beginning to the end. And you can outsource that. It's okay, but you need to take that decision and be aware that there will be work after that. It's not just getting a model, training it, putting it in production, which is something that Corey touched upon, that production is not the same definition for every company. And it changes, data changes, and the use cases change. There are some companies that want to add machine learning just because it's a trend, and this will increase their business value in some way because now it's modern to have AI on your website or whatever. There was something that I don't remember who mentioned it the other day. He said, well, they might as well just put the word and don't do any models at all. Just make it say it's AI. Well, this happens. And I think that those two types of mindset are totally different universes when it comes to how they hire people that are doing machine learning and how they execute in the process.
Yeah. I think what I'm finding, some of it is, of course, like, you know, sometimes initially, like everybody wants to call out that they're a machine learning driven company or AI driven company. So some might actually do it for publicity and all that. But I think, like in my company, of course, they're in their charter or the vision they have defined, like we are AI driven, you know, expert platform. So one is that the company has defined that as the mission or the vision. And secondly, how it translates into it is also how you're communicating in your, you know, it's kind of, you know, from your leadership down, right? So I find, you know, that it's very often mentioned in examples like, oh, you know, we were able to, you know, drive so much. So we were able to actually, you know, get money into the hands of our users because we have those experiences driven by machine learning. So I think when you actually tie your business, you know, whatever the business effect has been, and with how machine learning is driving that, actually, that's when it starts, you know, showing up and culturally inside that, you know, it seems like, oh, all teams are doing something with machine learning. So then other teams also get influenced and then they start thinking, oh, maybe we should also think about how machine learning can help us, you know, in actually making experiences better or, you know, better driving more value to the users. So I think it's culturally, it kind of spreads, you know, once your leadership start communicating and then you have examples which are being communicated. So I see this to be, you know, more successful model in terms of, you know, building that machine learning culture. Like, and then your products kind of start becoming like, you know, they are driven by machine learning and AI. But if it is not getting translated internally, like the messaging is very at a high level for like outside PR and all that, but you don't, but you're not actually tying the business impact with how machine learning is doing it. I think that's where I find like probably you're not really becoming like a product, an AI product driven company or whatnot. Yeah. So that's my take on it. At least I have found this thing to be pretty successful in my company. That, you know, we have leaderships actually talking a lot about how machine learning is driving some of these use cases and actually bringing value.
Yeah. I don't really have much else to say that Simran and Bessie like really just dropped the mic on their comments. I will say one thing at least, coming from a non-technology organization, we're brick and mortar. And one of the things that I have found has been beneficial is thinking about all of our machine learning applications and data science applications. Sometimes it's just simple regression. Thinking about those as like a product and really pushing that up to leadership and saying like, this is something you press a button on, turn on, and it never changes. You know, you have to evolve this thing. Data changes, model drifts, things, you know, all of that stuff that could occur. And so if we understand and respect that there is a tail, that there is a need to be able to reevaluate these things and have the right teams and people there, if something goes wrong, to fix it. Maybe just retraining a model doesn't solve it. Maybe I actually have to go back and reassess the methodology and techniques that I've used because the data has shifted so much. I mean, you know, COVID, anybody, you know, you think about COVID and how many models went boom. And then folks looked at it as like a project, and the project, your machine learning project is done. And then COVID nuked that whole thing. And it's like, oh, we have to take a look at these things over the long run? Yes, you do. And so I think if there's anything I would add, I would say that like that's been really beneficial for us. And that's kind of how me and my team think about it.
There's something that we were talking about, I think it was like 4 weeks ago, maybe 6 weeks ago. I can't really remember exactly when, but we had Oz on here and he was mentioning the dangers of basically getting into a POC loop, or what I called POC hell. And I'm wondering if you all have tips and tricks for making sure that projects get across the line. Because even in my own life, I think one of my biggest problems is starting with a lot of energy, getting to a certain point, and it's usually really close to the end, and then being like, okay, great, like it's good enough. And then dropping off and not getting that project across the line or making sure that the product is successful. So how are you all looking at that in making sure that these projects or products that you are creating are a success?
I think I'll chime this one off, is that what my team thinks about as well to keep that going is that you got to have a driver. I mean, I don't care about anybody. Energy starts to dissipate after so long. You know, I was looking at this piece of paper, writing up this strategy, and I was like, okay, I got 4,000 words sitting here staring back at me, and I pulled all this stuff together. I'm tired. Really just to have somebody to continue to be the driver. That's going to be the big thing right there, because if you just say team run off into the sunset without kind of keeping the drive going, having the customers be engaged, stakeholders be engaged, that's not really good. And so what we leverage is a concept we call agile data science. And so what we do is we kind of blend some of the agile, some of the waterfall, and then respect kind of like the uncertainty that is with building models from a development standpoint. And we engage stakeholders every step of the way. Hey, every 2 or 3 weeks, they come in and say, hey, our model methodology, this is what we're thinking. This is what we're looking at. There's nothing to show you, nothing to look at. Are we thinking about this appropriately? And we keep our stakeholders completely and fully engaged. And I think whether you're building something internal, external, like having some type of conversation with stakeholders and best, I'm sure you engage with the folks who you're thinking about serving one day to make sure that what you're building is going to make sense, and continue to do that poke and say, you know what, agile, the beauty of it, I can pivot because this doesn't really solve that problem. So that's what we do to help move that forward. And then the next thing is really kind of have criteria for what does done look like. What does, or let me rephrase that, what is good enough? Because sometimes perfect is the enemy of great. So we will clarify and say, you know what, this model isn't perfect, but guess what? I got 80% accuracy over what we're doing, which is pretty darn good, depending on what you're doing. It's not as well as it needs to be. Let's start delivering value to the business. And let's kind of say, all right, we're at that point, and now we have this maintenance wall where we're kind of continuing to learn and iterate and so forth. But for now, that is our criteria. And so I think that's also on us as product and project managers to be able to kind of have that clarity to say, you know what, reach this threshold, this goal, we're good. Because somebody tried to push on me one day and say, you know what, Corey, yeah. When you're doing a machine learning, a data science project, how do you put like a deadline on that? Am I going to tell my data scientist, you have a deadline to build this really complicated cold start problem, and I need this model ready to go in 2 weeks? It must be out your natural born mind. Enjoy getting something that's as good as a naive-based naive model. So anyhow, I'll be quiet right there, but that's kind of what we do. You just have to respect that there's uncertainty here.
I love how Corey is dropping the bombs at the end of his statements. It's just awesome how he does that. I can't agree more with you, Corey. It's just the things that you mentioned. The first thing about the energy, definitely you need to make sure if you are pushing such complex product forward, you need to make sure that the entire team on board is up and envisioning everything that you are visioning too, because in the end you have limited energy and you need to make sure that everybody else is involved, because sometimes you will be feeling a little bit low energy. You need to make sure that the machine is running. It's not stopping when you lose your energy, you get sick or something else happens. It needs to make keep moving. And the other thing that he mentioned about having a clear way to make decisions and how and what exactly done means. We also do that. We usually define very well what we expect on the different stages and how done will look like, because it's very, very easy to get drifted away when you want to perfect something. You are like, I want this, I want that, and it takes a week and then 2 more weeks and 3 more weeks. And then you are just ending up continuing that process endlessly. And you also have to have this higher goals that you need to always check if you are on the right path, because it's often you can deviate in a different direction. So clear goals, clear decision-making ways, clear framework about how you do things, and clear definition of what is done for you. I think that those are very helpful things to make sure that you deliver something that will do the job. That's the definition, something that will do the job. And another thing that we also like to use in our team is, it doesn't matter who proposed that. If it's doing the job, we do that. It's like no ego in the team. And we just do that test. If it does the job, it is the right decision.
And Simmer, maybe to bring us home, can you talk about how you, well, if you have anything to add on to that, but also I'm really interested to know how you avoid scope creep.
Yeah. So I think it's actually kind of ties with what, you know, the folks were talking about. And I wanted to stress on that. So you have to be very clear about the acceptance criteria. Whenever you take up a project, or, you know, you're defining what am I looking to achieve, you have, like, this is a common template. I mean, irrespective of whether you're building a product for, you know, like as I'm building a product, a platform, right? Maybe that's different from I'm actually doing a POC for a model, but instead now I'm doing a POC for a capability or a product, right? So for me, it is very important to clearly have the acceptance criteria, because that's like, I will spend more time initially just getting to the right document that I want, you know, everybody to be on the same page with respect to like, what are we really achieving here, right? So acceptance criteria is really important. Then second is the right set of people who will actually be involved in that POC, because sometimes the more people you have, actually it creates more confusion and sometimes more opinions. So I want actually the right set of people who will be involved in, you know, building it, testing it, and, you know, finally making a decision that this has met the acceptance criteria. Now, to avoid scope creep, I mean, if your acceptance criteria, you know, you have defined, you will actually, you know, hopefully will not have a scope creep. But I mean, it would happen sometimes that you are in the middle of your, let's say, the quarter or a sprints, and suddenly, you know, you hear out something that you think, oh, you know, the user need this also. So you have to go back and look at, oh, whether we can actually achieve that within that work, or is this actually another sprint or, you know, another, you know, significant work. Then I actually go back and honestly, you know, talk to the user, set the right expectation that this wasn't meant to be initially in our acceptance criteria. But if you're looking for this, then maybe we'll have to, you know, maybe wait for the next sprint release. So I think it's about being transparent. I mean, there is no other way. Being transparent about, you know, if I think what has really helped across my job, you know, in my previous company is good documentation, right? The more you think, put things on a paper where people have already read, commented, and agreed on, then they will not come back and say like, oh, you, I thought you said this, but I can always point them to the document saying like, hey guys, we all looked at the document, we all accepted it, and you all signed off, right? So then why are we asking this question again, right? So it has been really very useful, yeah.
I have a quick question for Simar about that. How do you deal with saboteurs? I mean, it's inevitable to have some people that are sabotaging what you're doing.
Right. I will tell you, if you can resolve it with them, like, you know, during your interaction, that's great. Align with them. But then most of the time, there is this leadership help that you need in those cases. You are externally, so you probably don't see that much. But internally, yes, there are always other teams who are building a clone what we are doing. So we have to, you know, work with our leadership, making sure, just showing that there is actually a value in having one solution and not having multiple solutions, because it helps, you know, with scale, you know, saving cost and all that. So definitely, you know, if you can align with them personally, it's good. But otherwise, we will get to the leadership and then, you know, ask for help there. Yeah.
Incredible. Incredible. So I want to just share what Corey put in the chat for those who are listening in the future and did not see it. He said, scope creep eats product teams for breakfast. Simar is sharing some great nuggets here. And with that, we're going to end this session. Thank you all for the incredible nuggets of wisdom. You have been amazing. And I've learned a ton. This is an area that I've been wanting to get better at. And so I'm learning from the best of them here. And I really appreciate y'all being very generous with your time and with your knowledge in the community. It's also excellent to have you there. And so if anyone wants to continue this conversation with them, hit them up on the community Slack. And for now, we're going to say goodbye. See you later, everybody.